if I look at data engineering, for example, I find that a lot of the large language models aren't really necessarily great at that domain. There's also this idea of organization and choosing what infrastructure and these types of things that you use. And I haven't found these models to be able to understand that nuance very well. I think from a pure data science perspective and a data analysis perspective, the models do an okay job, but there's second order thinking that they cannot do.
Welcome back to Insights by Design. We're here today with Ken G. Ken, how are you today?
I am wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
We're excited to have you. We've been circling each other in the virtual spaces. I've been watching you and on LinkedIn and YouTube and listening to all your different podcasts, and I'm happy to finally speak with you.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've obviously seen you around the interwebs as well, and it's great to finally connect.
And Ken, for those, oh crap, I'll edit that out. I gotta move this so I don't hit it. For Ken, for those who aren't familiar with your story, would you mind just giving us a quick background?
Yeah, I don't know how long a quick background is, but I'll give it the old college try. So, I started off absolutely not interested in anything technical at all. All I wanted to do growing up was to play professional golf. And that's one of the things that I organized and aligned my entire life around. So I was a pretty poor student, frankly, all the way through roughly my junior year of college. And I transferred schools, and I realized that my GPA actually reset when I transferred. So I decided to start taking it a little more seriously. Coincidentally, at the same time, I also took an economics class. And I fell in love with the topic. So understanding the world through trends, through data, through just this different lens was very appealing to me. And I had never sniffed that in any of the schoolwork that I had previously. It was kind of cool because at the same time as taking economics courses, I was introduced to statistics. And to me, there was this very easy way to see how this thing that I'm learning in the classroom, these statistics, would be very tangibly tools to improve my golf game. So I started analyzing my own golf stats, trying to improve my performance there. And I really went further down that path. So I tried to play professional golf, did not go as well as I had planned. I had a great time after college trying to do that, but my skills, my ability didn't necessarily match the what I needed to be able to make money in that domain. And so I decided to go back to school to develop some more skills and to try to really expand on what I had learned in the statistics domain before. So I did an internship at DraftKings, and I also went back and did my master's in global commerce at the University of Virginia. So DraftKings, I saw people using SQL. I had no clue what that was. They were using Python, they were using R to analyze a lot of data, and that really piqued my interest. So when I went back to grad school for the first time at Virginia, I picked up some SQL, I picked up some of these different skills. And I still wasn't completely immersed in the data and technology, but I'd learned the basics of regression and some other methodologies for doing data analysis. I went from there into management consulting. So I thought that that would be a great sort of vague area where I'd have a lot of options going forward, and I absolutely hated it. So coincidentally, around the same time, some guys I grew up playing golf with started a company called Scouts Consulting Group. And I went in and started working there in sports analytics. So through working at DraftKings, through doing some of these other things, I was starting to do model building and predicting sports outcomes. And I realized that I needed more skills to be able to refine and build on those techniques. So I went back and did my master's in computer science at DePaul. So with that, I was able to work in the real world doing sports analytics, but also to refine my skill set in computer science as well as in data science, AI, and machine learning, which is what I concentrated in that master's degree. So from there, I've been working in sports analytics ever since, either in a part-time or a full-time capacity. I took a couple segues away from Scouts, but over time I've come back there. And then obviously the YouTube and the podcasting content largely started when I was in grad school. I realized there wasn't necessarily a great roadmap for breaking into the data domain from non-technical domains like consulting. And I thought it would be useful for other people like myself to get a little bit more of a sense of what to learn and how to learn these things going in, because I didn't feel like there was those types of things accessible to me there. And then the podcast, I just enjoyed that part of it. To me, it was so cool to interview and talk to different people in the domain and learn from them that I just fell in love with that. And that's all I really felt like doing ever since.
Well, as a former caddy, I don't want to move on from the golf topic too quickly. And I wanted to ask, Ken, you're big into golf, you're big into data. What do you think the game of golf can teach data analysts? Are there mindsets or skills or other habits of mind that you learn in golf that can make you a better data analyst?
Yeah, for me, dealing with failure is a huge part of work life as well as golf. So in golf, the best players in the world, let's take a Tiger Woods or a Jack Nicklaus or a Ben Hogan. I think Ben Hogan only won maybe less than 20, around 20% of the tournaments he entered. It's a very bad rate. If you look at the average professional golfer, they're winning one in every maybe 400, 500 starts. Probably even less than that if I really had to think about it. So understanding that you're not necessarily going to win everything that you pursue is an important thing, but it's also realizing that that's part of the journey in your pursuit is a really important thing. When we come out of school and college, in theory, everyone can get straight A's. There's nothing, the way that the school system is designed, even if it's graded on a curve, is that basically there's going to be a large portion of people that succeed almost every time. And if you really put a ton of effort in, you're going to graduate with a high GPA. I don't think that the real world is like that. A lot of the things you do, you're not successful in. Let's take the job search or the job market. The vast majority of people are not succeeding in every interview and in every application they send in. And that's probably a lot more akin to that sort of failure percentage metric in golf. But the important thing is to persevere and to learn from all of these mistakes and adjustments. And I think that can be pulled into any area of your life. And it has been unbelievably valuable and useful to me.
And I love your journey, Ken, because you have a varied background. You went back to school. You went back to school twice. You have two master's degrees. I have two master's degrees. Michael has a master's and a PhD. Michael and I currently both work at ASU, and I am not the biggest advocate of school. I tell my kids all the time, I couldn't care less if they go to school. They just have to do something productive. What are your thoughts on the role of education, specifically formal higher education, in the data science job market?
So I've changed my views on this over time. I think historically, I believed that, well, I certainly believe you can learn everything on your own. Without a doubt, there's enough free resources. There's enough stuff out there that you 100% can learn everything you could possibly want to learn for free on the internet or for a very low cost. On the flip side of that, I think in the current job market, there is, which is frankly not good for data analysts and data scientists, differentiating factors do matter. So people with a master's degree generally are having a little bit more of a leg up because that is one more heuristic that employers can differentiate people on. Are there other ways that you can differentiate yourself without those? 100%. And I would wait some really good project experience building cool things that other people are using as even higher than maybe that degree would be. But again, if you're looking purely to differentiate yourself, that is one thing. The other side of that is cost. So I am in a tremendous amount of student loan debt. I pay quite a bit of money every month to pay off my degrees. Fortunately, I'm in a position where that's not really an issue in my broader finances. But there is some arithmetic to figure out if the return on investment of spending $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, maybe even $100,000 on certain degrees is necessarily worth it for you and what your earning potential is and what the risk is associated with that. So I personally believe that this is a very individualized choice. School might work really well for some people and not well for other people. I learned after that first stint in education where I essentially turned my academic career around that I work very well in a structured school education environment, but a lot of people don't function that way very well. If you're a hacker, if you're willing and are interested in picking apart problems and really diving into them, I don't think that there's necessarily a need for this higher level of education. I also think with the advancement of AI tools, there's a lot more individualized, immediate feedback forms of education that are going to be available. And frankly, those will be better than any college course that I've ever taken and any college type of teaching that I've ever done. So that's, I guess, where broadly I fall on that issue.
That's very helpful. And Michael and I are both working on projects to integrate AI into higher education. So I think the combination may be good. I want to get your feedback on this. One trend I'm seeing with students that I have across different universities is that if they haven't already had a data role and they're trying to break into data, a master's degree is the wrong way to do it. I only teach graduate students, and some of them have never been in data. They're getting a master's degree in data analytics or data science, but then they're trying to get an entry-level role, and suddenly it's not a differentiator. It makes them appear overqualified, and it may even make it harder for them to get an entry-level role. That's my opinion. What are your thoughts on that?
To be honest, I haven't thought that much about it. I think that a lot of companies, even if you're overqualified at this day and age, you know, why would they not hire you, in the sense that if they're getting someone at a discount because of the supply and demand characteristics of the market, it might benefit them overall. I will say that in general, the people that I do recommend to get master's degrees, I think it's sort of a no-brainer if your company is going to pay for it, or if it's free or very low cost. So there's a huge difference in cost of education in the US versus, for example, a lot of places in Europe, Germany, for example, where it's relatively low cost to pursue additional education in comparison. There's a huge increased incentive to do it, especially if you don't know exactly what you want to do, if you're sort of biding for time, and it is, again, almost free in comparison to the huge sums that you're paying in the US. I'd have to look at the data on what you're describing. I to be perfectly honest, I just have absolutely no idea.
What is developer advocacy and why does it matter?
So that's a good question. As we talk a little bit about offline, developer advocacy means very different things to different people. To me, I look at developer advocacy as the influencer marketing for companies in the data space. So what people are doing is they're hiring generally someone with a relatively large social presence, and they're able to tell the story of whatever company it is through the lens of a practitioner. And there's a lot of different ways to do this. Some of this is through blogs, some of it's through documentation, some of it's through YouTube or LinkedIn or content. And I think that there's definitely right and wrong ways to do this. So I've seen a lot of companies hiring developer advocates, and their goal is directly metrics driven. So the idea is that we need to get this many impressions, this many clicks, this many whatever it is. And I think that that provides a kind of a terrible incentive system, because the idea is to essentially just get more and more viewership, not necessarily higher quality viewership or a better understanding of the story of the company. In my opinion, the developer advocate should be focusing largely on creating documentation and building out a framework for what the platform or product that you're producing is and does, and creating this beautiful story, so that when you do turn on marketing, when you do turn on these things that drive traffic, there's a rich infrastructure, there's so much information, there's great documentation for people to come in and see. The problem is it's a lot harder to quantify the documentation, the blog posts, and these types of things, especially if they're getting very little views. But to me, there's more of this tiered phase type of plan where a developer advocate's role, in my opinion, should be the storytelling and the documentation, and they should be using the products routinely. So the whole metrics-driven approach, we're data scientists, I totally get that. But there's some stuff that it's very difficult to quantify right now, like your brand, the story you're trying to tell. And I think that that's what you're hiring in a developer advocate, you're hiring their artistry and their understanding of that, not just someone to push out content. Because if you want clickable content, you want these things, it's generally more controversial. It's generally not necessarily something you would want your company producing, but it would get results from the traditional metrics that you describe.
So you emphasize the importance of documentation and not just metrics. What kinds of documentation do you have in mind when we're talking about developer advocacy?
So documentation could be as bare bones as the actual like docs on GitHub and those types of things. I generally think of it more as examples of how to use the product or platform, whether it's video or whether it's text. I think a company that's done a really good job with this is Streamlit or even Posit with their Shiny for Python. You can go into either of those platforms and spin up a dashboard relatively quickly because you have someone who's created this template that other people can work from. It's so much easier to work and learn to use a tool when you can get it running to begin with and you can experiment around with it. To me, that is the lowest hanging fruit. If you have five or six different examples that might be really relevant to what your use case is, to me, that is a huge, huge, massive ROI for the company as well as for any of the people interested in using the products or platforms.
Yeah, the developer advocacy, I think I've seen a trend. Tell me if I'm on the right track. I used to see a lot of the DevRel folks being really super technical, hands on keyboard, working side by side with clients or potential clients. And I've seen a push more towards evangelism recently, where, as you noted, a lot of it is more the practitioner influence, a lot more of the social media, the tutorials on YouTube, where traditional DevRel didn't have that aspect to it. Do you have an opinion on what's driving that shift from traditional DevRel to more evangelism?
It's more just quantification, probably, in the sense that you can look how many views a video gets, you can track a link and see how many conversions or downloads you get. And I get that, that is important, but I think that a lot of companies are walking before they can run. They're saying, hey, I want to get this many views. I want people to see this product and to use it or to understand it. And then when they do get the views and the clicks, the conversion's unbelievably low because there isn't good documentation. There's no necessary groundwork that's been laid to be able to tell the story of the product or for people to get their hands dirty with the product.
And I've met with a lot of startups who are just rolling out evangelism. The large companies have had it for a long time. Amazon has had DevRel for a very long time. And I've seen these positions sit in lots of different areas within the company. I've seen sales, I've seen marketing, I've seen product. What's your opinion on where DevRel or developer advocate should sit within an organization?
That's a good question. I hadn't really thought of that one. Probably with product, that makes the most sense. I think that developer relations people are probably are closest with the community, and they are arguably getting some of the best feedback on the product possible. So if you're using these people effectively, you should be leveraging them into improving the quality of the product over time. I think marketing, I mean, maybe in the longer term, but I think marketing departments are largely too focused on metrics. And, you know, it's heresy for me, a data scientist, to be saying not to focus on metrics. But if there's anything that I've learned in this domain is that there's often things that are more important than just the raw metrics without context.
And you being a quote unquote influencer and having worked with lots of brands, you currently work with HP, several other brands, you've been to the NVIDIA conference representing HP. How do you think developer advocates should work with folks like yourself who are more independent influencers?
So I liked what NVIDIA has done. I like what HP has done. They've created really cool cohorts and programs where a lot of influencers can come together. I more consider myself a content creator where I'm just putting stuff out there. If people are influenced, that's on them. That's not something that I necessarily have control over. But I think giving the creators a lot of freedom to tell the stories that they are interested in telling about the products is the single best way that companies can support something like this. And it's also the way that they get the highest return on investment as well. So again, ZBuyHP and NVIDIA have done a great job of bringing together cohorts of people. I got to go to a dinner with 20, 30 other creators at GTC, got to talk to them, got to learn from them. And that's the biggest ROI that I can have as well, is that I get to meet all these different people. I get potential interviews, collaborations, all this other stuff. And, you know, that's not something that, if you get invited to those types of things, it's not something that a lot of companies or a lot of creators are like, oh, I have to get paid for that. It's no, you get the benefit of me going, as long as I get the benefit of meeting all these people and being a part of this process.
In addition to the people, what were some of your key takeaways from the NVIDIA GTC conference that you attended recently?
Yeah, so probably the biggest one is that AI is moving really fast and it's not going to slow down anytime soon. So we saw the Blackwell chip, which in my opinion is a massive upgrade from the Hopper architecture that they were using before. It seems like companies are going to be able to train these large language models dramatically faster than they were before. Also with less resource use in terms of electricity, which I think is generally a positive thing. But to me, it just seems like all of the advancements we're seeing are going to increase in inertia going forward. And I think in a lot of ways that's a good thing, but in other ways that's a frightening thing, because at this point I don't think we can conceptualize how fast things are moving as humans. I mean, it's at least widely discussed. I don't know if it's scientifically proven that humans are very good at thinking linearly in terms of time, but not exponentially in terms of growth. And based on everything I've seen, the advancements in AI are approaching an exponential growth curve. Whereas, again, we think in this linear growth curve. So I think that a lot of stuff is going to happen quicker than we expect. And I don't know if we're necessarily well equipped to be able to handle these rapid changes. I'm not saying anything necessarily is going to go wrong. But at the same time, if we're driving in a car at 40 miles per hour and we crash, we might get whiplash, we might get injured, whatever it is. But if we're driving in a car at 600, 1200 miles per hour, we might not crash. That's totally true. But if we crash, things can be a little bit more catastrophic in terms of what it means for us as humans. So that's generally the analogy that I approach things with. That doesn't mean that I think we should slow down. I think it's almost impossible to slow down the pace of innovation now. But it means that I am certainly evaluating some backup plans and things along those lines in case anything goes off the rails.
Yeah, you bring up a great point. I've been speaking with a lot of CTOs and CIOs who are pushing AI because they don't want to fall behind and they need to keep their boards happy. But at the same time, their data quality and data governance is having a tough time keeping up. What do you think is the key to balancing data governance with innovation?
In my personal opinion, innovation is almost always going to outpace our ability to govern these systems. You look at AI and the growth in terms of how we regulate that from a countrywide perspective, and it varies dramatically across different countries, across different continents, whatever it might be. And I don't think anyone is ever necessarily going to get it right. I think the best thing we can do is look at the core base principles of these systems and try to evaluate and create infrastructure that is flexible to adopting to what might be coming in the future. I mean, we at this point have to be looking at a world where we're going to have, in my opinion, indistinguishable video replication in a couple years. We already have almost indistinguishable audio replication, kind of pretty close with the image generation as well. And computers can generally already fool people with large language models into a human interaction, whatever it might be. So the idea there is that, you know, maybe I really don't know how to draw that line. All I know is that we should be focusing less on trying to adapt to each new innovation and more to the general broad direction that things are going.
So you mentioned looking at the base principles of these artificial intelligence systems. What about ethical principles? What ethical principles or frameworks can help us to innovate in a human-centered, sustainable way?
So there's this concept of human-focused AI or human-centric AI and design. And to me, understanding that everything that we create usually has a human end user is really important. So trying to design the experience for that human end user and essentially trying to do no harm. And how do we create as little harm while maximizing the good that these systems do is the best effort approach that we can do as well. I also think that the data that goes into training large language models or any of these types of things is very important. And we're probably a bit too cavalier with all the things that go into to train these things in terms of just looking for more data to be able to train bigger and bigger models. So again, not necessarily something that I think we have a ton of control over, but if I was building a large language infrastructure, I would be really trying to figure out how to curate what goes in, because that directly influences, or I guess technically indirectly influences what comes out.
Yeah, the UX often, unfortunately, comes after the infrastructure is built. And that's something Michael and I consult on, is building human-friendly AI applications. Because similar to data analysts, if they put out a dashboard and the data's wrong, then suddenly they've lost trust with all their stakeholders and they'll probably won't use the dashboard again or be more wary. With AI applications, so if something goes wrong or they have a poor experience, they've lost trust with that application. Now they're no longer going to use it. Are there any design principles or any companies that you feel like are doing AI design really well?
That's a tough question. I think that it's fairly lumpy. Like, some companies are doing things really well, but they're also doing things fairly poorly. And there isn't anyone that I think is doing things incredible. Well, I think Anthropic is doing a reasonable job. They've flown a little bit more under the radar. I realistically like what Meta's been doing with open sourcing Llama 2 and things along those lines. I'm a fairly large open source advocate because I think that that democratizes a lot of high level technology to people. On the other hand, I think we're running into a world where even if the models and the information is open source, access to a tremendous amount of compute is not. And we're going to be running into issues where it's not the ideas or the thoughts, it's the actual raw power that is missing from these open source communities. So to me, there's going to be an inherent private versus open source conflict. And it seems like private models are going to win because they have access to capital and resources and compute, which to me is a little bit of a sad thing, because I think open source has been one of the most beautiful things that humans have ever created in terms of our ability to grow and build together.
We saw something similar with the rise of machine learning. When I first got into machine learning in finance, everybody was still using SAS because they didn't trust Python and R because it was open source and it wasn't governed. A lot of places in Europe, they still use SAS for those reasons. Italy primarily uses SAS. They don't use open source. We see a similar trend with AI, where companies are gravitating more towards the closed models, the OpenAI, Anthropic, or running something on top of Azure. Do you think that we will eventually get to the place where we trust open source AI as much as we trust open source machine learning?
Unfortunately, probably not. I think that, again, the access to resources that these companies have and the privatized nature means that they can develop and innovate in a way that is dramatically greater than open source communities can. Even if you have all these great minds, yes, they'll probably make incredible efficiencies in how these things work, but then these private companies will just go in and take these efficiencies and build them into the models they're producing. So because they have access to capital as well as effectively all of the knowledge in open source, how could they not just continually stay ahead of the curve of what open source can do. So I don't think it's necessarily an issue of trust. I mean, I think that people genuinely trust the models that are being produced in the open source community. It's more that they'll frankly just be inferior because they don't have the prerequisite of the compute power to be able to do this.
And with AI rolling out, you've seen it, I've seen it pushing further into the data realm and actually performing data functions. In your opinion, what are some things that either data analysts, engineers, or scientists can do to future-proof their job potential?
So learning to prompt, learning what these systems are good at and not good at, I think is really important. If I look at data engineering, for example, I find that a lot of the large language models aren't really necessarily great at that domain. There's also this idea of organization and choosing what infrastructure and these types of things that you use. And I haven't found these models to be able to understand that nuance very well. I think from a pure data science perspective and a data analysis perspective, the models do an okay job, but there's second order thinking that they cannot do. And well, obviously they can't really do any thinking, but the idea that it can get a really good baseline, but understanding nuance of an ask takes a lot of prompting, and arguably more prompting than it would take to do it yourself. So that might change very aggressively in the future. I'm very much using them to create visuals, do things along those lines, work with different libraries. But my core programming knowledge and my understanding of how things fit together and how to build complex systems, I think is dramatically better than the AI will be for a reasonable period of time. If it's just writing a script, that's one thing. But if it's writing an actual application or building something that is more than one notebook, to me, there's limitations to what these things can do right now. So I think more broadly, being able to combine data analyst or data scientist skills with that of someone in product, in terms of building systems that other people are going to use, you're going to be better off doing that. But also, again, having an understanding of how the different models that are out there function and what their strengths and weaknesses are.
So in addition to those technological skills, Ken, what kinds of soft skills or commercial skills will help data scientists, analysts, engineers future-proof their jobs?
So the number one skill for me is meta learning. So the idea that you can pick up something new quickly, something that I learned in my master's in computer science was programming languages aren't all that different, right? You might have some different ways variables are stored. You might have call by value, pass by value, whatever it might be. But the idea that I can pick up a new language relatively quickly because the fundamentals of loops and of these different structures are relatively the same was huge for me. This is even more important as we go forward, where there's new technologies coming out very frequently. The idea that you can read a research paper and understand what it means is important. And this can also be augmented and helped by a lot of these tools. So if you are really good at prompting and using ChatGPT or Claude or any of these things in an effective way, that can help you pick up new tools even faster than you could before. And to me, that sort of meta skill of learning and adopting and adapting is one of the most useful things you can do. Obviously, the interpersonal skills are unbelievably important. I think one of the best ways that you can differentiate is either convince people that you are capable or to be able to get people to like you. And if we're talking purely in a job context, I think that those are really important things. Most of the time still, humans are making decisions around if people should get hired. And those are two things that can objectively change your outcome into how people view you. So I have stressed and worked really hard to become as articulate as possible. To me, I've been getting a ton of reps doing that, podcasting, going on podcasts, watching my footage pack, these types of things. Mm-hmm. Not saying everyone has to do that, but those skills have taken me very far in my career, even in comparison to the data skills that I've developed.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, because even in the context of getting hired, yes, you need to immediately convey that articulation and build that credibility and rapport with the hiring manager and team. But even after you're hired, you still need to get promoted. You still need to get your project funded. You need people to buy in and build relationships with stakeholders. What are some ways, other than starting a podcast and being on Ken's Nearest Neighbors, that analysts and scientists can build some of those skills?
So something I recommend to everyone is to practice writing. I know that sounds kind of weird, but if you can write down your thoughts, that means you essentially can clearly articulate them, and you can structure them and pass them on. What a lot of people forget is that in the work world, especially if you're working remote, the majority of the conversations you have with people as an engineer are through writing. So it's through Slack, it's through email, it's through these types of things. It's not necessarily picking up the phone and being on a call. So if you can very clearly communicate via the written medium, the vast majority of your interactions are going to be improved, and your people's perspective of you are going to be improved, because it's going to be very clear. And people think that, and I also believe that if you can digest and write these things clearly, you should be able to speak them clearly as well. So you're sort of getting a two for one. That doesn't mean you necessarily need to start a blog. It could be helpful, but just being able to write things down and structure your thoughts in that way and pass that on to other people is something that I think people should practice indexing on more.
Michael, I know you have a question.
No, I just wanted to Ken to keep going down that road, because that's exactly what I teach. That's you keep giving all these awesome shout outs to technical communication. And so I'm trying to think how to phrase this exactly, but how do you overcome writing anxiety? Mm.
The blank page problem.
So at least for me, every day I have a little journal / diary. I just write down what I was doing that day. You also don't necessarily need to write something completely original. So something I've been doing for my other podcast is I'll just take a quote that I like and write what I think about it. So you're starting with something that is source material and you're extrapolating on that. So it could be just commenting code. Something as easy as that is, hey, I wrote this function. What does it mean? Why did I do this? What is the methodology that I followed to make it effective? And to me, that is writing. That is problem solving through the written medium. And so a lot of people, they get this writer's block because they're staring at a blank page. You don't have to stare at anything blank. We're not going to be graded on our creative writing assignment every time we go out. A lot of people also just will talk into a voice recorder or something along those lines, and then they edit it into the written form. Sometimes that works well for people as well. I personally haven't really had a problem with that front. Sometimes I just don't feel like writing, and I think that's okay too. But those would probably be the best tips I have. You also do have ChatGPT, Claude, any of these types of things. I've actually gone away from using them to write, because I feel like it's impossible for them to write it in my voice. I've tried a lot. I've put in a lot of my own writing and things along those lines. But to get started, I don't think it's bad in terms of like, hey, write me the first sentence of this, and then you can follow along, or give me an outline of bullet points associated with this, and you fill in the blanks. I think that those are totally acceptable ways to use these things.
And you're finding that personal and reflective kinds of writing translate well into other forms of writing, like the kinds you would do in a business context?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that writing is writing, as long as it's not necessary. I mean, to-do lists even help us to organize our thoughts, right? Where whenever I'm taking on a big task, I have to break it down into small chunks. I mean, what more is writing than essentially organizing thought onto a page so someone else can digest it, or you can digest it more effectively?
I love how you get back to first principles of to improve thinking, write, probably to improve attention, probably read. I find a lot of those things. It's so easy to either get the serotonin hit or to multitask, and then we lose a lot of our ability to do that deep work and that deep concentration. Do you have any other tips for folks who are trying to improve themselves?
Yeah, I want to echo what you said with reading. So one of my favorite podcasts is the Founders Podcast by David Senra. And one of his things, he got it from somewhere, but I'm going to attribute it to him, is that reading is forced meditation, where you're focusing specifically on a topic. I also do enjoy just regular meditation, just sort of sitting there. To me, that is the single best way to train focus, is to be able to let things pass by without you necessarily clinging your thoughts to them. That has been unbelievably helpful, especially in the mornings where, you know, there's so much stuff going on. It was worse when I was in Hawaii and, you know, I wake up at 8 a.m. Hawaii time and the rest of the world is already running full speed. And so I wake up and there's just all this stuff going on and I'm playing catch up all day. Since I moved to Texas, it's a little better because I wake up early and I don't have to worry about that as much. But finding a way to find some quiet and be able to dedicate time to focus on the things that you care about is it is so important to anyone who's trying to do something meaningful in their work.
And you're also a big jiu-jitsu guy. Do you get out there and roll when you're working through a data science problem?
Not as much. So I had shoulder surgery about 2 months ago, so I haven't been on the mats in a little bit. Honestly, that's very meditative for me as well, where I'm able, it's one of the very few things that I do where I can fully take my mind off of everything else in the world. It's hard to think about why your code is not working when someone's trying to strangle you. So that to me, in a very weird way, is like a great way to unwind and to not necessarily distract myself, but immerse myself in something different. Obviously, I grew up playing golf at a very high level, but golf, it's 4 hours, probably minimum, you're on the course. You hit shots for maybe 10 minutes of that time when you're out there. So you have a lot of time to think about things. And in jiu-jitsu, some of these other sports, you don't really have time to think about these things because it's so involved. And I've really liked both of those. You know, sometimes I can go on the golf course and I don't bring my phone and I can really just immerse myself in the game and the beauty of nature. But it's a lot easier for me to go an hour and a half and train jiu-jitsu and not think about anything because there's so much going on. And, you know, the fight or flight really kicks in as well.
Oh, 100%.
Let's flesh this out a bit more. What can jiu-jitsu teach us about data analytics or data science?
That's a good question. So, at least for me, I've realized from training in jiu-jitsu that my other problems are relatively inconsequential. So again, this idea that, again, someone is trying to strangle me, that the physical response and the psychological response of the, not necessarily trauma, but of the threat to my body is so much greater than anything that could happen to me sitting at my computer. And that gives me a really good perspective about what is meaningful, what is not meaningful. No message I get from a boss or no news that I would get is going to be more threatening to me than physical violence against me. And the idea also is that I think jiu-jitsu is really good for problem solving and thinking. So a big part of jiu-jitsu is learning techniques, implementing them, but also figuring out a game that works well for you and your body type. So the broader thing here is that I have to take in a situation very similar to maybe the job market. So I look at what I'm good at, what skills connect to the skills that I already have, and how does that make me a unique piece to the puzzle to be able to defend myself or to disrupt other people's games. If we look at that, again, in the frame of a data science domain, again, what strengths do I have? What complementary skills can I build into my skill set that make me competitive against the other people in the job market or be able to serve the company that I'm at that fill in gaps that they don't have there. So I've thought a lot strategically about jiu-jitsu. And again, what are my capabilities? What are not my capabilities? I think so often people focus only on what their weaknesses are or they focus on what they think the market needs rather than looking internally and figuring out what they're actually good at and what they could be doing to get marginally increasing returns on the time they put in rather than diminishing returns on the time they put in.
Wonderful. Ken, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.